Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Omega Leadership Series show. We are live in studio again this week with best-selling author Lori Beth Jones, leading our discussions from her book, Teach Your Team to Fish. Welcome, Lori Beth.
Welcome, Shelley. Welcome to you welcoming me. Thank you.
Great. You're welcome. I can see you're in a space of gratitude today.
Yes.
As always. Well, it's great that you're in a space of gratitude because we're going to be talking about adversity. So we need to be in a great space to talk about that. Wow, what an interesting topic, Lori, out of your book, out of this section of, how Jesus prepared his team. By looking at some of these principles that you've written about, this week we're looking at adversity and stewardship, how stewardship is not ownership. And sometimes we feel entitled or privileged, and we forget that really we're just stewards of these gifts that God has given to us. And so I'm excited to be here with you today to unpack these two chapters in your book, Teach Your Team to Fish, in looking at how Omega leaders form, develop, and lead their team. So let's jump in. Sound fun?
Yes.
Well, I think one of the things that struck me about this particular chapter, and I've heard you often speak on something similar to this. In the book, you talk about everyone will hate you because of me. I mean, how much more adversity could you, start a company with to develop a team, an organization, gathering a core group of people by telling them, you know what? Pretty much everybody's going to hate you because of me. If you come and work for me, this is what will happen.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about your thinking behind that as you were writing those words.
Well, it goes to the core premise of the four things that Jesus did with his team. He excited them like fire. He grounded them like earth. He transformed them like water. And he released them like the wind. And in the grounding process, this is something that's really unusual about him as a leader, because a lot of people can whip the troops up and get their enthusiasm up, you know, rah-rah, making them feel good. But then when they get hit, the rah-rah feeling goes away, and that's when people get discouraged or quit or walk away. And Jesus was just adamant about telling people up front what the true cost was going to be. And in doing that, he displayed transparency, candor, honesty, and it also helped filter out a lot of the, you know, the wannabes, the people who were hanging out because he healed them and fed them, and I'm sure he told a good joke or two. So it's really a filtering device that leaders need to use and be aware of in recruiting their team and also in training their team.
How much time in your experience, Lori, in working with teams and organizations, do you believe that that the leadership or the management spends on preparing? I think you one of your tweets this week was, how do you prepare your team to not flinch at a critical moment? How much time do we spend preparing for adversity, even, you know, as a country, as a society, as a team, as an organization?
Well, we just passed the anniversary of Pearl Harbor just a day or two ago, and, you know, we were not prepared for an attack. Our ships were all in the same place, and you know, it was a stunning reminder that attack can come from any time at any place. And with leadership, I love the image of Nehemiah, how he had his workers, they kept one hand on their sword and the other one they were laying the bricks as they built the wall, which you might say slowed things down. But as a people, a nomadic people, they were often under attack. And as you tour Europe and you see all these castles on the hills, those were fortresses, really, because people were under attack. And certainly spiritually, we must be prepared for the attack of the enemy or the evil one that Jesus said. Not that we look for the devil or Satan under every corner, but that we're not surprised when we get challenged or when someone says something bad about us. Or, you know, I'm just constantly amazed at the people who build their houses right on the river's edge and then are just shocked when it gets flooded. You know, it's just like you kind of are right there and the rivers do swell and at least don't act surprised. You know, you have to be prepared for this because of where you situated your home. So it has to go, it goes towards planning and advanced thinking. And I love that phrase, he did not flinch at the critical moment.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a great epithet, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Powerful.
Yeah. I'm trying to get an image of that, you know, in different realms of life. You know, I think we're, you know, speaking of myself, often feel like I'm in reactionary mode to something, or, you know, whether it's positive or negative, you know, it gets attention. And, you know, just being in that place of calm, preparing the team or the management or the leadership to be ready at any moment for, you know, whatever shows up. I was reading, I think it was a Fast Company blog today, in regards to how smaller teams and organizations tend to be more creative and flexible. You know, just because of their size and they're trying to survive, and so they're always ready to turn right or left, go forward or backward, sideways, you know, dig under the ground, go around the steam, you know, whatever.
Right.
Whereas
right.
Larger companies, they're just not that nimble, and so. Paranoia sets in if something, you know, goes wrong or, you know, didn't go as planned, or maybe they're just not as creative because they have the massive size or number of employees. And so it was an interesting article about this very thing that you're talking about, not flinching at that critical moment of, you know, I just think that's a, wow, it's a great image. And I wonder what it would be like to be in that kind of space most of the time. And do you think Jesus was in that space most of the time?
Yes, and I think a lot of it has to do with the way we frame situations and label them good or bad. And I know maybe our listeners are familiar with the story of the man years ago, and a wild horse came running in, and everybody said, "Oh, how wonderful, this this stallion has come. You got a free horse." And so he trained his son to ride the horse, and the horse bucked him off and ran away. So not only did he not have a horse, but he had a son with a broken leg. And all the village said, "Oh, this is bad." You know, when the horse had come, "Oh, this is great." Well, then the king came through, and he was drafting all healthy young men to go to war, but because this man's son had fallen and broken his leg, he wasn't able to go to war. And they said, and the villagers said, "Oh, this was really good that your son broke his leg." And then the stallion came back with a herd of mares, and so the man had a son that was still at home and a whole herd of horses, and all the village said, "Oh, this is very good." So, you know, it's all in the context of what's going to happen next as to whether things are bad or good. I was just visiting some friends, and this particular friend had been through a really rough spot, or a divorce and then a subsequent bankruptcy, and that's just about as, you know, those are two of the highest stressors that you can go through. And yet when we went to dinner with her, we observed that she's happier now than she's been in 15 years because she got rid of a very unhappy marriage and a business that was just drowning her. And now she's free to create and go to parties and do these things. And so it was amazing to think about how freeing that even in the midst of all of that heartache, God, in a way, was setting her free to live out the next few years, however many she has, in joy. So you can't always judge. And Jesus was really good about that. You know, she isn't dead, she's sleeping. Or
right.
Don't rejoice because of this. Think about that. He was always framing things in a different way.
And maybe that's one of the keys, Lori, to this whole concept of and principle of adversity and not flinching, you know, at a critical moment. Is it part of that reframing? You know, that Jesus was such a master at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it really goes to a sense of balance and poise that, you know, God is with us in the darkness, God is with us in the sunshine, God is with us in our tears, God is with us. That whole book of Job, which actually was the first recorded part of the Torah, evidently, was a story of a man who had prosperity and then adversity and then prosperity. But his faith remained constant throughout. So I think it's a lesson for us not to get too attached to the form of things. You know, companies and people want success, and they love success stories. And yet there's a saying that says, whom the gods would destroy, they grant early fame. And so, wow, how great to be a child star and famous or whatever, but then you look at some of their lives and what they deal with, it's just, it's not always a blessing.
Right. I love the story in this chapter that you talk about John Pirelli as a horse trainer.
Yes.
Such a powerful image. Do you remember that story?
Oh, yes. It's one of my favorite stories. I tell it all the time when I'm speaking. John Pirelli is a famous horse trainer, and there was an ad in a magazine that showed him sitting on a horse in the middle of a field with no bridle, no reins, no saddle, no visible means of control, and the horse was relaxed, in a relaxed stance with its ears pointing forward, which means it's alert and happy, basically. And it would be unusual for him to be sitting on the horse enough without anything on it, but what was really unusual was what was going on around the horse. There was a helicopter hovering maybe 30 feet above it, and there were people dressed in clown costumes and with umbrellas and, you know, coming at this horse. And the horse was just as calm as could be. And I say that, you know, what is a John Pirelli-trained horse worth?
Right.
Because he has trained that horse not to flinch at the critical moment. That no matter what is going on around him, to stay in tune with his master, which, how beautiful for us if we could be that way as well.
Wow, great image. Love that story too. And so in kind of summing up this principle of adversity, it's always going to be there, right? I mean, it's part of the daily life, you know, as a leader, as a CEO. It's part of our culture, and so preparing our team, our organizations, people that we're working with or consulting with, coaching, that to think about it, to not ignore it, and possibly teach a way to reframe adversity as Jesus demonstrated in this chapter. Wow.
And the balance of that, Shelley, is I think you and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday. How do you move forward in faith and innocence and still be prepared for adversity? You know, you don't want the notion of adversity to shut you down in fear and cynicism, and, you know, you stay in the fetal position in bed because you think that adversity is going to come your way. But how do you move into the world with this sense of wonder and joy and still be prepared and not surprised when adversity happens? I think that's the balance that we live as business people and as Christians in faith, not to be surprised when bad things happen, but always to expect the best no matter what.
Great word. That was a great word. Thank you. Let's talk about this next concept, Lori. He taught stewardship, not ownership. This passage here, right at the beginning of of Scripture, Genesis 2:15, God took the man and settled him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate and take care of it. You talk about how this passage really is kind of the beginning of what stewardship was all about, you know, in the beginning of time. And, you know, we look at that story of creation as the story of creation, but, you know, could we frame that and reframe that as the beginning of stewardship? I think that's one of the points that you're trying to make here in this process. So talk to us about a little bit about your thoughts as you pen this.
Well, you know, we're in the middle of a shift in consciousness about this whole notion of stewardship. And I think that technology and the internet and our ways of connecting and being aware of what's going on has really led us to become more stewardship-minded. I was on a trip to Alaska this summer, and on the bus, we were heading into the Denali Wilderness, and on a bus, they showed a movie about Alaska, and it had been made by Walt Disney. And you could tell it was made in the 50s or the 60s because it had the ultra technicolor and kind of the grainy quality to it. But they were showing about Alaska, and it showed all these logging companies just cutting down timber. And it showed these fishermen hauling in just, you know, tons of fish. And it, you could sense the people on the bus were wincing because it was a throwback to the time where we went in and just took the resources we wanted. Trees, wow, gold, wow, oil, wow, fish, wow, buffalo, wow, we want them, we got them. And it was really an uncomfortableness that was palpable on the bus with that notion, even 30 years ago or 40 years ago, that we could just take Alaska and it could feed us all we wanted. And now it's, you know, children are being conscious of how much energy they use, and people are aware of recycling and all of those things, which is wonderful. We're moving into the stewardship mentality, and not a moment too soon.
Right, and you talk about, you know, the difference in the two words, that owner means one who has or possesses, and steward means one who manages another's property, finances, or affairs. And that this is a huge difference. You know, that is a big difference of owning something or stewarding something.
Right. When you're the owner, there's no accountability. When you're the steward, you will answer to someone. And it means you better pay attention to the details and not just look after your own interests. There's a passage in Jeremiah where God is really angry at the shepherds because they have not cared for the sheep. They have not bound up the wounded or looked for those that were lost, but they have eaten the fat, kept the best for themselves. And he is furious because they developed an attitude of ownership rather than stewardship as priests. People.
There's a story in here where you talk about doing some work with the CEO of the Adventist Health System, and he was taking you around to meet, introduce you to some of the people there, and this one particular woman said that she was that God had given her the hospital. She had been there something like 25 years or something like that, and she had you know, just kind of flabbergasted, I think, the CEO and you, in that you guys laughed because of her assessment of ownership, you know, as part of that, of a calling. She felt it as a calling, but really she became a steward inside that organization.
Yes, and I recall he was going around to each person, how long have you worked here, how long have you worked here? And they were saying 5 years, 7 years, 11 years, 20 years, and she basically said, well, God, this is my hospital. God gave it to me 26 years ago.
You know?
And so there was a sense of ownership with a beautiful notion of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I have a framed saying in my office from Georgia O'Keeffe that says, I own this. God gave it to me. He said if I painted it enough, I could have it. And she's talking
mm-hmm.
about the desert, you know, the New Mexico desert. And certainly nobody has done more to show the beauty of the land in that regard than Georgia O'Keeffe. So she stewarded the beauty through her artwork, the land of enchantment.
Wow. Beautifully said. Wow. Great picture. There's another place here in the book where you talk about changing your name on a business card. If every business leader, owner, changed their name from owner to, or their title from owner to steward, how would that change our behavior in our society, in our companies, in our organizations?
Well, it's, you know, I have a beautiful privilege of working with America's Christian Credit Union, and their motto, when they brought in somebody to really look at the different values and interviewed all the different departments, and what they revealed was that the core value the group has is stewardship in action.
Mm.
And so they manage over $500 million in assets. And every question is, you know, is this a good way to steward the Lord's money and our members' money? And you know, they've come through shining in the midst of financial crisis and upheaval because they
mm-hmm.
took that motto of stewardship, that these are not our funds, but we're here to do kingdom work.
You know, and as a society, Lori, and this is kind of putting you on the spot to come up with this, with this information, but I know you have your pulse on a lot of things economically. But there's a lot of organizations that do good and that give back or that steward or serve. What percentage of our society do you think act as stewards as compared to owners?
Well, I think that one of the things that made America great was this notion of giving back. You know, historically, we are the givers. We are very generous in giving to charity and to other nations, and some might say too generous. But it's that notion of giving that got us where we are, and yet the taking, the shift towards taking what is ours has brought us to the brink. I know you were talking to a couple in the church that said they were going to go live in Argentina because they'd rather be middle class in a country that is developing rather than upper class in a country that's on its way to becoming a third world country
right.
because of our debt. So they certainly see things differently.
Right. Well, you know, I was leading a group of teens over the last few weeks through the Path for Teens, and we got to the vision process of the Path for Teens program, you know, where these teenagers are writing their vision as if it were 10 years from now. So they're, you know, most of them would have been 26, 25, 26 years old. And they, as they read their vision statements out loud, it was so moving and compelling to hear, you know, what their minds could imagine themselves doing, you know, 10 years from now. But almost all of them were giving back to society in a huge way. It's like there's this strand in our DNA that we know that we're supposed to be stewards, and it's there, and if the opportunity arises, it's called out. But then there's this other side of us, the other side of our brain, you know, says, you know, we've got to conquer, we've got to own it, we've got to, you know, tear that down and put a parking lot, or, you know, it's this dance, I think, sometimes that we do. But I'm with you. I think that our society, you know, for the most part, I would say for the most part, that people have this special place within where stewardship is elevated, where it does shine and where it does come out.
Yes, the notion of giving, I believe, is in our DNA. And greed is something that shuts it down, and that's something that we all have to guard against. When we start saying I and my instead of we,
mm-hmm.
and thine.
Exactly. Well, good words. This will be a good place to kind of take us out through the remaining couple of minutes that we have together. But you talk about yourself here at the end of this chapter, and it says, for example, as an author, I am not the owner of my books, but a steward of the information that has been given to me. And I just want to say, you know, Lori, that is so like you, you know, to talk about yourself like that. But it is so true of you. You know, the words of your pen and your speaking, you know, go forth to help shape others, and, you know, in marvelous ways. My gosh, the list could be forever today. But what a beautiful image as well of the works of your hand. Thank you for sharing that with us at the end of this chapter.
Well, thank you, Shelley. You are too generous. But I was thinking, I was thinking about a phrase that I read recently, and it said, we are drunk with generosity because we have stumbled into the granary and are telling us about it. And I think that, you know, when you get that notion of, or the reality of divine connection, and I mean, imagine if you stumbled in and you realized it was in your name, and you walked up and you saw the treasury and it had your name on it, and you walked in, you know, you'd be running out just scattering coins, bullion or whatever it was, because you knew you had this inheritance. And this was Jesus's message to us, that we have this. And I'm thinking of my niece Tara, when she was, I guess, maybe 5 years old, for Christmas, she wanted to give presents to everybody, but her mother said, oh, you don't have to do that. And Tara indicated that she very much wanted to make sure everybody got a present in our family. So she said, what do I have? What do I have? And she decided that she had money in her piggy bank. So for Christmas, she broke open her piggy bank, and in little pieces of paper, she wrapped coins, the different coins, and we each got a certain amount of coins. And she broke open her piggy bank, and she gave it all away at Christmas. And I remember our grandfather, whom she just really adored, is her great-grandfather, he got 12 cents. And the rest of us got maybe three. But it was just, she broke it open, man. She wasn't holding back. And that's the spirit of joy, I think, that God calls us to live with. Break open the piggy bank, you know. Give it all away because you own it. It is yours.
That's a great word, great picture, too. Well, let's all be drunken with generosity. What a great way to close this show. Thank you, Lori Beth, for your words today, for your gifts of stewardship in to us all. Thank you so much. Have a great evening, everyone. We will see you next week.
Thank you, Shelley, for your faithfulness and time in putting these shows together.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.